Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
Also, this guy.
Kate.
This guy.
Welcome to Late Med Crimes.
Ooh.
Listen,
we're late.
It was me this time.
Yep.
Sometimes things get in the way.
Yeah, it's fine.
And trust me, it's like a drop dead last resort when we have to push it out.
It really kind of is. We actually really flex our lives to try to stay on schedule.
We do.
Once in a while, shit pops up. And you know what? The important thing is everybody is fine. We're all fine. Hours are fine. Our kids are fine.
Yes.
Everything is
It has nothing to do with the families. Everybody's safe, fine, happy,
and
loved.
It was just a thing. That's you know what? We're moving on. Everything's great.
It was a thing that just made podcasting not really feasible.
Yeah.
We're all good. Everybody's good. Moving on, moving up.
Happy
the
to be
quote
back.
The of my last 24 hours is don't let the bastards grind you down.
Do
I have any Handmaid's Tales friends, fans here?
So I love Handmaid's Tale. I've read the book and I watched the first couple of seasons and I love it. But somehow I have not gotten on board with like the last season and a half. So
you need to do a rewatch.
I need to do a rewatch from the beginning because it's a phenomenal show and the acting is just
so that has gotten me through the last 24 hours to bring us here to what we are today.
We are great. Everything is great.
I am a pro at taking the high road.
You really are. And you took the high. I mean, you
have a lot of experience.
You are the queen of taking the high road at this point. You have unfortunately had to take the high road way more times than anybody should have to take the fucking high road.
I'm so good at it, but please stop.
Are you just like driving on the high road going, I fucking hate this road. It's so fucking overfamiliar.
I'm on it all the time.
I'm just always on this fucking road.
Get me off this highway.
Anywho.
Do we have Patreons?
We have one Patreon.
Yeah.
Okay. Patreon, Kristen Andrews.
Ooh, hey, Kristen Andrews.
Thank you, Kristen. You are a real one. Also, I know what you are.
Ooh.
You are a shapeshifter, which is a really good one because...
Oh, Cole.
To interrupt me very rudely, Julian McMahon passed, which we're all very sad. And we used to watch Charmed in our dorm room together.
Where are my Charmed fans at?
So we're just mourning a little bit, but everything is okay. Also, Nip Tuck was a fabulous show.
They had shapeshifters on Charmed.
Yes, they did.
That's where I got that from. So.
But shapeshifters are actually present in like many, many, many cultures all over the world. And they are exactly what they sound like. You can shapeshift into whatever shit you want. It's way cooler than any other of those stupid creatures like vampires and goblins and shit. Because you know what? You can be anything you want. We are going to talk about Shiro Ishii and Unit 731.
Shiro Ishii.
Uh-huh.
I'm just going to sit back. I have a hot cup of coffee.
Yes.
It's mid-July and I'm under a blanket. Don't ask me why. That's just the vibe right now.
Can I just, real quick, before we dive into this shitstorm. So Devin comes over. There are kids running around because my niece was there. My kids were there and her kid is upstairs playing with my kid and our kids are being kids together. And she walks in and I was like fixing something on the coffee machine. I was not planning on.
You like just like rearranged.
I just
something,
like rearranged something. You were like, you just zoomed up to me with a big smile on your face and said, are you making coffee? And I was like, I am now. Because he looked so fucking excited about it.
Folks, get yourself a best friend that just can read between the lines.
I just clearly...
That picks up on voice tones.
Yes, I had it. I grabbed it. Anyway, Devin has coffee.
Oh, God.
So, yes, we are going to talk about Shiro Ishii in Unit 731. And so the way we're going to do this is we're going to kind of break down... This first episode is going to be very history heavy because we need to kind of go into the context of everything, how this started,
give me the
why
background
it started...
Deets.
Give you the background and talk about, you know, what was going on in the world, because all of it is connected. It's all sort of part of World War II, which we've gone into before. And this very much echoes the Holocaust, Josef Mengele, who we've covered in episodes. So lots of vibes like that.
I don't want to say love that time period because I hate what happened, but I get
it's an interesting
a
time
lot of
period.
Interest peaked.
100%
on that time period.
Oh, I totally get what you're saying. And again, it's not because like we love what happened. Of course, we don't love what happened. We love that we don't love, but it's just, it is a very real thing that happened in our history. It's wild and crazy that it happened the way it did. It's crazy that humanity got to that point. And what's sort of even crazier is that this part that we're going to talk about isn't talked about a whole lot. And great. And I'm kind of like,
that's probably why I'm like, what are we talking
about? It's so interesting. And I even asked my husband, who is, you guys, a history buff and specifically through a World War II and Civil War buff. The man loves this crap. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, hey, what do you know about the Sino-Japanese War? He said, absolutely nothing. I know nothing about it. Nothing. I was like, well, this is a first for me. This is the first time I've ever asked him about something in history that he had no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he knew little bits. He knows about, like, the role, some of the role Japan played in World War II. He knows but specifically this, he didn't know anything
stories
about.
Stories and cases that came
exactly.
out of it.
So, this is really interesting.
Here we go.
I am going to say, sorry, Cece had a game open. I am going to say, we're going to get, like I said, this first part's going to be kind of history heavy. We're going to start getting into what happened to people in Unit 731 sort of towards the end of this first episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we are just going to lightly graze the atrocities that happened there. We're going to blow on it just ever so slightly. And then in part two, we're going to get into the much more nitty gritty, the much heavier stuff that happened to people. And then, of course, we'll talk about, you know, how the whistle blew, what happened within the Japanese government and the downfall of it, and what happened to Shiro Ishii after all of that.
Bring it on.
Let's bring it on .com. So, Shiro Ishii was a Japanese microbiologist and army medical officer who served as the director of Unit 731. And Unit 731, just as a quick intro, was a biological warfare unit of the Imperial Japanese Army, or the IGA. IJA. I'm sorry. I can't let her. IJA. And then Ishii led the development and application of biological weapons in Unit 731 during the Second Sino-Japanese War from 1937 to 1945.
Biological weapons scare the shit out of me.
And that was the entire, like, purpose of Unit 731, or about 90% of the purpose of Unit 731 was the development and refinement of biological warfare. So, including, like, the bubonic plague attacks on Japanese cities and on parts of China, biological attacks that were getting planned against the United States. And Ishii and his colleagues did this essentially through human experimentation. So that's why I said this is sort of, like, very much like Josef Mengele. Mm-hmm. And actually, Shiro Ishii is referred to in a lot of the texts and articles that I read as the Josef Mengele of the East, or Josef Mengele of Japan.
Okay.
So let's start
Josef 2.0.
Josef 2.0. So we all know a lot about World War II, about Pearl Harbor, Japan's involvement that way. But what was interesting for me, again, was to dive deeper into Japan's actions during and in the beginning of World War II in Asia, specifically, because I didn't personally know about any of this. So here we go. And setting the scene, so the Second Sino-Japanese War was fought between the Republic of China and the Empire of Japan. And this was, again, between 1937 and 1945. And it's considered part of World War II. And it's often regarded as the beginning of World War II within Asia. And it's the largest Asian war in the 20th century. And it has been described as the Asian Holocaust, actually, just to reference the scale of Japanese war crimes against specifically Chinese people, some other peoples, but mostly Chinese people.
Gives you a comparison for that part of the world.
So I think it's important to note that the estimated deaths resulting from Japan's war crimes throughout World War II, from Unit 731 to the various invasions, the massacres, the rape of Nanking, this, that, and the other thing, everything, actually, in all likelihood, way outnumbered the Holocaust.
Really?
Isn't that insane? I did not know this. So it's estimated that between 3 and 10 million people were murdered as a result of Japan's actions. And that does not include, like, when we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, that doesn't include any of that. That's all Japan's war crimes.
Wow.
Murdering Chinese civilians, prisoners of war, all of that.
Holy crap.
So again, it's interesting that this doesn't get talked about more because we all know, like, those
I mean, you talk about D-Day. You talk about yes. everything that went on in Italy, France, Germany, sure. the yep. U.S. Mm-hmm. as far as, mm-hmm. you know, wow, holy crap, Pearl Harbor.
Exactly.
And just, whew.
And we all know, because we've talked about it here on this show, and because it's a big part of, like, the history that we get taught in schools, about the ideologies that were fostered behind the Holocaust mm. and, like, all of the ideas that were perpetuated by the Nazi regime during this time, and, like, the beliefs that there was a superior race and that right. the Aryan race was superior to all others. And Japan at the time was led by Emperor Hirohito, and he was actually friends with Hitler. They were buds.
Hey, pal.
So the Japanese people revered the emperor. Like, he was a very well-loved emperor. He was feared. He was even to the point of the Japanese people sort of believing that he was this mystical being. And some actually said that he was a god or a descendant from a god or the gods. But he wasn't necessarily considered like an actual god in the Western sense. It was more likely widely believed that he was such this powerful, like, and connected guy to the gods that he was likely like a descendant himself. Mm. So the Japanese government actually took this ideology and they bolstered it and they perpetuated it and they used it to fuel further propaganda that Japan was the superior country and the superior race within the Eastern countries.
Ouch.
So Japan now has this ideology while we have this emperor who's wonderful and who's basically a god. And if you're Chinese or Korean or any other race within the East, fuck you. We're going to eradicate you.
Sounding familiar?
Yeah.
At all,
well, that's exactly
to current, not even to the Holocaust, but to like to shit yeah. right now.
Oh, I know. And I hope my goal here is not to perpetuate
no, of course,
any racism.
Of course not, but
because it's just like when we were talking about what went on in Europe and what went on, mm-hmm. you know, what the Nazi ideologies were, what was going on in Germany and France at the time, mm-hmm. when we talked about Marcel Petiot and all mm-hmm. of that, you know, mm-hmm. all the same stuff. And then the other thing that made Japan and subsequently its armies so deadly was the immense shame that came with giving up and surrendering. So, like, at literally anything, but most ardently, like, with war and battle, right?
Their man egos.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Very much so. So Japanese soldiers and leaders were trained to fight and die, and surrendering is not an option. Giving up is not an option. It is absolutely out of the question. So leadership in Japan would never like see the damage that they're undertaking and cut their losses and retreat. They would just fucking win or die trying. Like, there is no surrendering. So that's one of the things that made Japan so fucking formidable, is that they would not stop. And they had a lot of numbers. Their numbers were astronomical. Mm. So it was every battle, every massacre it tended to be overwhelming in favor of Japan, because they just had so many people that were so ardently in support of their country and their emperor, and they were such a formidable and dangerous army.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just ended up being a really awful time for China and neighboring countries, but mostly China, let's be right. honest.
Yeah.
So from 1931 to 1937, China and Japan engaged in like these skirmishes, including in multiple different areas in Shanghai and in northern China. Chinese nationalist and communist forces had fought each other in the Chinese Civil War since 1927. So it was really nothing new. But in late 1933, the Japanese like encircled a bunch of Chinese communists in an attempt to finally destroy them, forcing the communists into the Long March. Have you heard of the Long March?
Mm-mm.
So essentially, it resulted in communist China losing like 90% of their forces.
Oh,
like
wow.
It was a devastating blow to China. And this is why, with a lot of what Japan did, China couldn't fight back a whole lot, because they were down 90%, 90% of their forces. So a full scale war begins July of 1937 with there was the Marco Polo Bridge incident near Beijing. This was like, again, it's like invasion after little battle, after massacre, mm-hmm, after mm-hmm. this, that, and like slowly Japan is expanding and taking all of these territories, mainly in China.
Okay.
And like establishing all of these base camps, like all over the place, mm-hmm. mostly in China.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just like a civilian in China, like, you're fucked, basically, because right. there's no one around to protect you. There's right. really no armies or anyone that's able to fight back unless you're just like fighting back on your own. So when men, women and children were just being taken prisoners of war Ugh. And murdered just in droves.
Oh, gosh.
And it was described that during and like during this and like even before Unit 731 and during Unit 731, it was like, to estimate the number of casualties, officials actually had to do math. When they found these mass graves, they had to be like, okay, in order to estimate how many people are buried here, we have to calculate how deep this hole is, like what the average mass of a body is, and like figure it out that way. That's how they're...
Geometry and stuff from high school.
That's right? literally... Like, that's they're having to mm-hmm. calculate bodies and numbers of casualties that mm-hmm. way, because there's just mass grave after mass grave after mass gosh. Grave, and quantifying these deaths was like no impossible.
No way.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
So, okay, the Japanese captured the capital of Nanjing in 1937 and perpetrated the Nanjing Massacre, yet another slaughter of droves of mm-hmm. Chinese people. And after failing to stop the Japanese capture of Wuhan in 1938, which was China's de facto capital at the time. So, like, they establish a new capital because it's been overtaken by Japan, and Japan fucking takes that, too. Finally, Chinese people are just like retreating further into China because Japan is just like absolutely overtaking all of these lands. And then, of course, in December of 1941, Japan launched a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor and declared war on the United States as well. And Japan formally surrendered on September 2nd of 1945, following the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and subsequent invasions. And the war resulted, and the war in total resulted in around 20 million deaths. I mean, this was an insane scale. Just, I mean, we were not alive at that time. So, like, clearly, we don't know how that feels to just, like, be existing at a time where this amount of
that mass, yeah,
of just catastrophe is going on around you. And, like, the turmoil, the geopolitical turmoil.
And I really can't, you know. No, because, you know, just even when any time catastrophe happens and you think about trying to put yourself into that situation and mm-hmm. how you would feel, I mean, let's just quickly put in here, Texas. I'm sorry.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
I can't imagine, you know, just thinking about that community, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And take that times a million throughout, you know what I mean? Just as far as like what that country's going through and what the civilians are going through and the, you know, in mm-hmm. a war type atmosphere versus natural disaster.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, these were in China. It was like, I mean, World War, you obviously didn't have phones and like social media, but you had like newspapers mm-hmm. and stuff. And it was like, you're just sitting waiting for your village to be next.
Right.
You know, and there was like really no one there to support you.
I mean,
to
I've read a lot of books and stuff, mostly from the Europe standpoint, mm-hmm. You know, historical
yes.
fiction and
yeah.
stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they try to put it from the civilian perspective and stuff. Mm-hmm. And even just in literature fiction perspective, they try to paint the picture.
Yeah.
And it still doesn't do it justice.
It
I'm
doesn't.
Sure.
And then it feels like you're just reading this like story, right? It's mm-hmm. hard to believe that all of this actually happened and right. that humanity is actually capable of mm-hmm. stuff like this. Mm-hmm. So it just, that's why stuff like this is so interesting to me, I guess, because mm-hmm. again, it's just like shocking to me that this is a thing that even happened in our history. So, Unit 731, which is short for Manchu Detachment 731. I'm not exactly sure why it was called that, to be honest, but it was also called the Ishii Unit because it ended up being led by Shiro Ishii, was this covert chemical warfare research and development unit of the Imperial Japanese Army that engaged in all of this human experimentation and biological warfare manufacturing during this war. And so we're going to talk about Dr. Shiro Ishii and how he came to be a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So Shiro Ishii was born in Chiyoda Mura, in Japan. And again, also, please know I'm doing my very best with the pronunciations here.
I know, come on. Give her a break, folks. Okay, this is phenomenal.
Please don't at me. I looked up all of the things that I could.
You're lucky it's not a Devonism.
I'm doing my best over here. Come on. I'm limping through it, baby. So Shiro was the fourth son of Katsuya Ishii, who was a wealthy landowner and sake maker. And the Ishii family was the community's largest landholder and exercised like a feudal dominance over the local village and like all the surrounding villages. So they were like a formidable family. Even when this guy was a kid, he had a fucking silver spoon up his ass, and like his whole family, it sounds like, were just like these formidable like stronghold in their community and then surrounding communities, like, oh, the Ishiis, like, don't fuck with them type of thing. So Ishii attended the Chiba Middle School in Chiba City. Some of his classmates would go on to say that they regarded him as brash, abrasive, arrogant. And in 1916, Ishii enrolled at Faculty of Medicine, which was in Kyoto Imperial University, to study medicine. And he graduated in 1920, and he ended up marrying the daughter of Akari Torisuburo, the university's president, in that same year. So, and then in 1921, he was commissioned into the Imperial Japanese Army as a military surgeon. And he started out with the rank of Army Surgeon First Class, or Surgeon Lieutenant. And in 1922, Ishii was assigned to the First Army Hospital and Army Medical School in Tokyo, where his work impressed his superiors enough to enable him to return to Kyoto Imperial University and pursue more postgraduate medical schooling in 1924. Mm. So during his studies, Ishii would often grow bacteria as pets in multiple petri dishes.
I mean,
which is a little unusual.
To say it's pets, I mean, is odd.
That's quirky. I mean, that's
you're supposed to grow things in petri dishes, but
I feel like
you're my pretty. Yeah. Like, what? I don't understand.
I mean, you might see like some fuzz on there and some dots. I don't know. Like,
is it like a chia pet? Like,
that's the impression that I'm getting. The visual that comes with that is just like really disturbing, and I don't really know where to go with that. But
I'm lost.
He literally, and like, he would not hide this. Like, he regarded these bacteria as like his companions. And buddy, he didn't always like grow them to research. He just grew them to like have a petri dish of fucking whatever, like that he could just have as a companion, which I just
that's a new one.
It's a really new one.
That's
okay.
A new one.
He did not get along with his classmates and most of the time his colleagues.
I mean, they probably didn't have enough fungi for him, so
he was pushy. He was indifferent about everybody. One of his mentors, Professor Rin Kimura, actually recalled that Ishii had this odd habit of doing his lab work in the middle of the night and using lab equipment that had been carefully cleaned by his classmates earlier. And his classmates would be really mad when they came in and found the laboratory equipment all dirty the next morning, because he would just use all the shit, not clean it, and then everybody else would have to clean it for him. This guy's a jerk and a half. He's such a jerk.
With his pets.
Yes, with his pet bacteria petri dishes. And then in 1925, when he completed his postgraduate studies, he was promoted to Army Surgeon Second Class, also known as Surgeon Captain. So he's climbing the ranks within the Imperial Japanese Army.
With his friends.
Mm-hmm, with his friends that hate him because he's kind of a jerk. Nobody liked this guy.
I meant the petri dishes.
Those petri dishes will like you.
And pets.
You just keep feeding them agar and they will be your friends forever. By 1927, Ishii was advocating for the creation of Japanese bioweapons program. And so then in 1928, this began like this 2-year tour in the West, where he did extensive research on the effects of biological warfare and chemical warfare from World War I onwards, basically, is what he was researching. And then Ishii's travels, I guess, were highly successful and helped him with the with convincing officials to let him like really kind of go rogue with this.
Mm-hmm.
And then in January of 1931, Ishii received a promotion to senior army surgeon third class, which is surgeon major.
OK. Okay.
And according to Ishii's followers, Ishii was extremely loyal to the emperor, had an enthusiastic personality, and a daring, carefree attitude. He had very eccentric work habits, such as working late into the night or in the middle of the night, like I had said. He was also known for heavy drinking, womanizing, and embezzling. So he was like, just doing all the shit. He was just raw dogging it.
He makes me think of a commander. Back to Handmaid's Tale, by yeah, the way. Oh, like, okay. That's what he's striking me as right now. Yeah,
he's just like doing his own thing. Imagine doesn't really give Lawrence. A fuck.
I mean, no, we like that guy, but okay. I mean, him yeah. with a Petri dish next.
Oh, yeah, just I with mean, a Petri dish.
Yeah.
Devin is still on the Petri dish. This is a lot for her.
Remember Carl Tanzler and what I could, the flowers and the smell? There's
How
just
can
certain,
we forget?
There's just certain things I can't get over.
There's things right? that Devin cannot be expected to let go of.
Yeah.
That's all fair. So. Ishii was described as this vehement nationalist, like anything outside of the realm of Japan being the superior race in Asia mm-hmm. was like, that was just out of the question for him. Mm-hmm. And all of that helped him like sort of gain access to the people who could provide him the funds to continue his research. So around this time, Unit 731 is being like conceived and thought about, right? And Japan initiated this biological weapons program during the 1930s due to the prohibition of biological weapons and the interstate conflicts by the Geneva Protocol of 1925. So they reasoned that the ban verified its effectiveness as a weapon. And Japan's occupation in Manchuria began in 1931 after the Japanese invaded that area. So this was going to be like the first area that the first base of Unit 731 was going to be set up was in Manchuria. So they developed this huge research facility, and basically the Japanese government gave Shiro Ishii any funds and any access to anybody that he needed. So he had like an unlimited number of prisoners of war, essentially Chinese citizens mm-hmm. who were just being snatched. And these facilities contained more than just medical research and experimentation areas. They also had a big detention area. So like in the facilities, there were these big rooms where all of these victims would just be like detaining. They would be like detained and essentially functioning as a prison, but like a way overcrowded prison. And then the research and experimentation rooms were constructed around the detention area, allowing the researchers to do their daily work while also like keeping an eye on the prisoners all in the middle.
I can do my lab studies while babysitting.
Exactly. I can babysit all the prisoners. And then ultimately founded in 1936, established like officially for the first time and became working in 1936. Unit 731 was then expanded to include 3,000 staff members, 150 different structures, and the capacity to detain 600 prisoners concurrently for experimental purposes.
Oh, ouch.
So this is growing and growing and growing really rapidly.
These humans are my new Petri dishes.
Yeah, like, fuck the Petri dishes. So the organization dedicated to the advancement of biological weaponry within the Imperial Army, was also known as like the Ishii Network. So like anybody in this system that was contributing to Unit 731 was within the Ishii Network. So okay. He's like the guy that's
he's
presiding
the title
over
of the network.
He yeah. really is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In order to like keep it quiet about like what was going on there, the official name like that went on the record and on the books of what the Unit 731 was called the Epidemic Prevention Research Laboratory. So like that sounds okay. nice.
I was gonna say, I mean, I get it if that's what you were doing.
That sounds very cushy. It sounds very nice. And they were
very demure,
very demure,
mindful.
Very cutesy, very mindful. Not so much. They had all of these different like offshoot labs, and they were all advancing and expanding so quickly that they just these efforts culminated in the experimental deployment of biological weapons on Chinese cities in direct breach of the Geneva Protocol. So like the Geneva Convention that was signed in 1925, like essentially said you cannot use biochemical warfare, like that is against the rules of war, and so like all these countries were supposed to like have agreed to it
mm-hmm.
and Japan directly violated that by doing this by developing further biological weapons, biological warfare in order to use them on other countries.
Okay.
So, and in 1935, Ishii was then promoted to senior army surgeon, second class, or surgeon lieutenant colonel. And in August 1st of 1936, Ishii would be given formal control over Unit 731 exclusively and all of its research facilities. Oh, now, wow, with this new title. So he's the king of everything that happened there.
Now overseeing the Ishii network and others.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So a former member of the Unit 731 staff actually recalled during a 1998 interview that when he first met Ishii in Tokyo, he was surprised at the commander's appearance. He said Ishii was like, he said, quote, Ishii was slovenly dressed. His uniform was covered with food stains and ashes from numerous cigarettes. His officer's sword was poorly fastened and dragged on the floor, end quote. However, when he was in Manchuria, this guy said that he met him later on and it was like he was a different character. He was dressed immaculately. His uniform was spotless. His sword was tied correctly. And all of a sudden he was like put together. So I don't know what was going on with this guy. He was just a complete wild card, I guess.
I mean, I have to say, day to day, I look disheveled. And other days, I'm like, dang, I got it going on. So
I got days where I got no bra. And I got other days where I put under eye corrector on and I look halfway decent.
You know?
Yeah. No, I got you. I got you.
That one depends on the day.
So, yeah, heavily depends on the day. So, military police and the Special Services Army were responsible for finding victims to test, as to be test subjects for Unit 731. So, while there was a group of physicians who were responsible for, like, maintaining the healthy victims and, like, healing them after we would experiment on them so that we can reuse them as much as they can and then dispatch them for other experiments. Like there were groups of people that were out on the streets just grabbing people. So literally it would be like Chinese civilians, men, women, and children that were just snatched off the streets and shoved into vans.
Oh, damn.
And brought to these places.
Oh, gosh.
And that is where they met their end. And it was thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
And I'm sorry, did I space for a second? Are they just searching for any person that they can just snatch up?
Literally anybody.
Or are they targeting like Germany did with the Jewish?
Not necessarily. So
they just need bodies to experiment on at this point.
They just need people.
Okay.
They just need human beings. And while biological and chemical weapons were not like new to warfare, Japan testing them on human subjects was completely unparalleled. And even by the Nazis. I mean, the Nazis did human experimentation, but they did not do it to this scale that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes this all the more barbaric was that Japan, like their contribution to medical science just like three decades earlier. So like 30 years before this all happened, like Japan was sort of on the forefront, like in terms of medicine and discovering, you know, like things like germ theory, things like refining surgical procedures, bacteria and virus research was like headed by Japan. Like they have come out like 30 years before with a lot of really valuable and incredible contributions to medical science in general. So like it's crazy that it took a turn like this, because I mean, Japan could have done so much better. They could have done so much better.
Right.
You know?
Come on, guys.
And honestly, the research that came out of Unit 731 is stuff that is still, like, used today. I mean,
it was beneficial.
I mean, not really, because they murdered a gajillion million people.
What I mean
people.
Is, like, no, of course that's no, not know. Beneficial. Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like
at the end of the day, it wasn't
useful knowledge. Yes, what they got
out of
but
it,
but the means to get
yes,
there
was completely barbaric. Okay. Yes, absolutely.
It's not like they didn't get anything out of it, and you know what I mean. And mm-hmm. it just went away.
I do know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now a U.S. Army doctor named Lewis Livingston Seaman observed colleagues who were attending the Imperial Japanese Army, like during the Russo-Japanese War in 1904 to 1905. And Dr. Seaman actually came away from that experience profoundly impressed with the medical knowledge mm-hmm. that he had gained there. And he had stated, quote, "The history of warfare for centuries has proven that in prolonged campaigns, the first or actual enemy kills 20% of the total mortality in the conflict, while the second or silent enemy, disease, kills 80%.
Mm.
So a lot of like the disease and epidemic research that came out of that period with Japan was really like unprecedented stuff.
Wow.
And he had gone on to say, quote, "I unhesitatingly assert that the greatest conquest of Japan has been in the humanities of war and the stopping of needless sacrifice of life through preventable disease. Japan is the first country in the world to recognize that the greatest enemy in war is not the opposing army, but a foe more treacherous and dangerous, preventable diseases, as found lurking in every camp, whose fatalities in every great war of history have numbered from 4 to 20 times as many of those mines, bullets, and shells."
Wow.
So, like, I mean, this could have been a really shining, triumphant moment for Japan if they didn't go and fuck it all up.
Mm-hmm.
So they had started all this having this reputation of being pioneers in medicine, which I think is why, part of the reason why the Imperial Japanese Army funneled so much fucking funds and resources into Unit 731 and all of that research.
Everybody was behind them because they thought they were the elitists.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So Ishii was such a staunch nationalist and was essentially given free range by the Japanese government and access to as many Chinese POWs as he desired. With the Japanese takeover of Manchuria, this provided this perfect area to test one of his first ideas, which was to turn bacteria into airborne gas. That was one of his first. He's like, okay, this is the basics. How do we weaponize bacteria into an airborne gas and control it and contain it so that we can detonate it when and where we want to? And what coverage is that going to give us? You know, how dangerous would it be for us to handle? All the details of that. So, under the cover of the ironically named Epidemic Prevention and Research Laboratory, Ishii had set up shop in the Army's hospital in Tokyo also. So they had a little wing in there too. And the location was only temporarily used because to accomplish his objectives, he would need to access greater resources, which was provided mostly in Manchuria. So in Manchuria, they had a lot more like humans, basically. Mm-hmm. They had a lot more humans because it was in China. Access to more people. So Ishii's goal of turning bacteria into gas and then subsequently into weapons for the IJA required a lot of study, and it's not as simple as it sounds. I mean, it sounds simple, but there's a lot that wasn't known about it at the time. And there was this belief in general that animals really couldn't supply any usable data because animals can't converse with us and tell us what they're feeling, how they're feeling, and this, that, and the other thing. That's why that's how they rationalized using human beings for all of this. So the vans that would like be going around and like plucking people off the streets were known as ravens. Had become known as ravens, like among the community, like, oh, watch out, here come the ravens. And then it's like, so-and-so gets snatched off the street and is never to be seen again.
God.
Can
you imagine?
Oh my gosh. No, I cannot. I can't imagine. I literally cannot. And this, literally, Japan's military police is doing this. Just snatching Japanese citizens off the streets. And of essentially
their own people.
Japan's not doing it to their own people. They're doing it to Chinese.
China, people. Sorry, yes.
So in 1932, Dr. Ishii chose the city of Harbin, which was in like the southwest of Manchuria as the first biological and chemical weapons specific facility. So this is where they were going to start that research on how do we weaponize bacteria. So
this is probably how what's her face that we talked about a few episodes ago got her black market. Was it VRE? Yeah. What was it?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yes. There's so much shit that goes on in this world that none of us even fucking know about. I mean, it is wild.
Starting from Unit 731.
Maybe. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe.
So if somebody in the army like became opposed to using prisoners of war and medical experimentation, they would be labeled as a traitor. And
that's it.
If they refused to take part, it was seen as a failure on their part. Their family was dishonored. They were dishonored. There was so much shame with it. And like,
wow.
If you're Japanese, shame is there, like, the shame is not allowed.
No, for
very taboo.
Yeah.
Right. So most of the medical professionals that were involved in this all were, you know, they saw their work as noble. You know, this is benefiting our empire, our Japanese empire. We are the best. We are working to maintain our best selves and to further biochemical warfare research. And it's only going to help Japan succeed. So Unit 731 started receiving all of this state-of-the-art equipment. They had, like, again, a nearly unlimited supply of the funds. Every doctor, every staff member, every guard, everybody who worked in Unit 731 was very well compensated. They had the best places to stay. They had the best food every day. I mean, they were very well taken care of, very generously taken care of. At one point, from Unit 731, there was this big escape attempt where 40 prisoners all busted out. Unfortunately, they were all captured and killed shortly afterwards. Oh,
come on. Not even one of them?
And I know. I know. But this happened in the Harbin facility that was recently opened. So that sort of prompted them to actually move a lot of their operation from Harbin into Pingfang in 1936. And they did that because this complex was a lot more, it was a lot huger. It was actually 70 building complex. It was absolutely massive. And then the perimeter had essentially like these big walls around it. So it was a more secure facility, basically. So it was in Pingfang where they began doing something that they later became notorious for, which was vivisections. And if you're not familiar with the term vivisection, you're lucky.
All right. I'm lucky.
A vivisection refers to the practice of performing surgical procedures on living specimens, otherwise known as a living dissection. And for Japan, anytime this, in Unit 731, it was widely believed that anesthesia or sedation of any kind would skew their data. So they never used anesthesia, pain medicine, nothing. They believed it would interfere with their results. So essentially these
What are they dissecting? Like, they're dissecting us, but like where, what? What are you?
Anything and everything. So what they would do is they would expose somebody to a pathogen or a virus or bacteria or what have you. Put them away, tuck them away in confinement, wait for it to sort of set in and for them to become symptomatic.
Become ill and spread.
And then they would just cut this person open look at their organs to see what this pathogen was doing to their organs.
Oh my gosh.
Of course, many people died of blood loss, shock, infection, of course, all of that. But the doctors that were employed there, part of their task was to take care of them, sew them back up, heal them so that they could just keep reusing them over and over again.
Today we were checking out your lung. Yeah. Tomorrow's going to be your gallbladder,
pancreas, like, or whatever. Yeah. And then people in the surrounding area would later there were constant screams of, "Don't do it. I'm not dead. I can feel this.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God."
I know. So,
the fear
again
that those
men, women, and children.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
So that is why this is so scary. And you guys, this is literally just like a whisper of what they did.
You were going to tell me like that they were giving them these pathogens and they were getting sick and they were dying and they were testing them.
Oh, no, this is way worse, honey.
Cutting and dissecting of them came out of nowhere.
You do not even know the bit. Like, you don't even know. No, this is not even the tip of the iceberg. This is the fucking fog floating over the tip of the iceberg. You don't even know. It is so we will get into it, obviously, more heavily in part two.
I don't want to.
I know you don't want to, but you have to because you're here.
Because me up for the shit.
This is just one example of the brutality, and this is why Ishii is referred to as the Josef Mengele of the East. This is why. So as immense as Pingfang was, Unit 731 also had affiliated locations in Nanking, Beijing, Changchun. Altogether, there were 26 known killing laboratories that were active at the same time. 26.
In this
Pingfang. For Japan. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And the total number of personnel involved reached about 20,000. All units and facilities were coordinated by Ishii, essentially. He did all of this. And the research was made available not just because of the army hospital in Manchuria, but to doctors and educators throughout Japan. And in this way, Unit 731 was performing the service of human experiment for the entire Japanese medical community.
Oh, goodness.
And an ongoing feedback loop. Dag. This is a really bothersome, like, fact about this whole thing.
Oh,
so
crap.
The construction of the Ping Fang establishment prompted locals to, like, ask, what is this place? And the official answer that was given was that it was a lumber mill. And out of that, regarding this reply, one of the researchers joked, quote, and the people are the logs.
Oh, come on.
Fuck whoever that guy was. And this literally became an ongoing joke among researchers throughout all of the facilities. The people were logs. And they would ask each other, hey, how many logs did you cut today? Oh, you know, I cut three. Like, how many? Like, the fact that they reduced these human beings, these children, these human beings to inanimate objects is, I don't know why that just butters it with like this extra layer of fucking depravity, but it bothers me to no end. No fucking end.
Well, I mean, it's like the base, you know, lumber mills, like, you use wood for so many things. It's at your pleasure. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And like, people do whatever the hell they want with it. Yeah. So it could compare a human being to a log.
Exactly. And then from then on, the Japanese term for log, maruda, was used to speak of the prisoners whose last days were being spent in Unit 731, getting infected with lethal pathogens and then torn apart.
What the
hell? Over and over and over again.
This is maddening.
So, as noted earlier, the primary objective for Ishii in Unit 731 was the creation of biological warfare, and to facilitate that end, human experimentation was utilized, including the vivisection of thousands of people, and many, many, many more atrocities that we are going to get into in part two. Sorry.
You really was thinking that I was just prepared for people to become ill.
I told you this.
And then now they're getting cut in half. And I'm
so there's a lot more, and you're.
I hope I'm in a better headspace in 2 weeks.
I think you will be, but I'm going to. It's going to quickly deteriorate again after the next episode because holy fuck, you have no idea. I don't know if I should warn you and like prepare you or if I should just let it unfold.
Well, be prepared, people. Part two.
Part two is gnarly.
Listening to support us, but maybe just play it and put it on mute or something.
We'll have some trigger warnings, like a lot of them.
Okay.
Because this might be the trigger warning-iest episode that we've ever done, honestly.
Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you for continuing to support us. Thank you for understanding why we're a little late with this episode.
Love you.
And you can continue to listen to us at... where?
Are you okay?
No.
Oh my God.
You can find us on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast. I had a blank space.
Where are we?
Where can you find us?
You can find us on YouTube with Med Crimes Podcast as well.
You can search for us on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
You want to become a Patreon? You can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast. It's fun there.
You can send us any crazy story suggestions, topics, anything for our next episode of Break Room Banter at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there. Please don't get snatched up by a big black van.
Don't let the bastards grind you down.
That's right. Don't you let those bastards grind you down.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
Bye.